We're checking in on the restaurant industry in Wisconsin on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. The most recent data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows Wisconsin's hospitality industry remains nearly 30,000 jobs below pre-pandemic levels. The National Restaurant Association is urging Congress to provide additional federal aid to restaurants that are struggling. And in a letter to congressional leaders, they asked to replenish the Restaurant Revitalization Fund that has been stalled in Congress. Do you work in the hospitality industry? How are you doing? 800-642-1234. Danielle Bearwald is board chair for the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, whose members include thousands of food service businesses. She owns Irv's Mug in Oak Creek. Danielle, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So starting with those inflationary pressures, inflation hits everyone in the pocketbook. How is it affecting restaurants like yours in the restaurant industry as a whole?
Well, I think it's affected us.
Infected as well.
It's a better word. It's from one end to the other at the receiving side. You know, we're seeing an increase in food, just as everyone is at the grocery stores, but we're also seeing an increase in the costs of goods to provide the food. So when you talk about a go order, you have the box and the plastic fork and all of those types of things. All of those things have gone up or are not available in some cases. There's been a struggle that way as well. In addition, you've had the increased labor costs, which continue to grow as the demand for increased wages, particularly in the hospitality industry. I believe we've tried to step up and make sure that we are living wages. We are paying living wages to our staff. We are providing a decent income to attract the staff and hold on to the staff that we have. So we're seeing it on every facet of the business right now.
Before we go on to staffing, I was just struck by even the smallest detail, like a plastic fork costing 5 cents. Every single penny hits the bottom line of that restaurant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when you talk about the 5 cent fork and the 30 cent cup and the 25 cent box and the oil that we fry the fish fries in went from under a dollar to a dollar and a half a pound. It grows and grows. And the volume that you're looking at, you know, it's only 5 cent fork, but you're using, you know, several thousand of them a week. Mm-hmm. So it adds up pretty quickly.
So looking at staffing, and I just looked at these numbers this morning, ZipRecruiter data as of last week, the average annual pay for a restaurant server in Wisconsin, $23,000 a year. Indeed's data last week, average salary for a restaurant staff in Wisconsin, $12.41 per hour, $45 tips per day. What needs to happen with wages?
I think there's a lot of restaurants, particularly in the quick service segment, that offer those first-time jobs. We offer the pathway to becoming a skilled employee to our teenagers. And those wages certainly get skewed, in my belief, down from the wages that are being paid a line cook or certainly a chef or a manager. When you look at the wages that are being paid our teenagers to come in and learn skills, both soft skills, how to relate to people, how to deal with their fellow employees, how to show up on time, what a broom looks like in some cases, how to sweep a floor. Those are skills that we teach to those young 14, 15, 16-year-olds. And we're going to need two or three of those individuals to fill a job position that an adult would fill with just one body. So I think the wages do get skewed to some degree, at least in our case. Hmm. Our 14 and 15-year-olds are not paid as much as our adults who are supporting families, and this is their full-time career. So I think there has to be some recognition of that that the wages being paid to the young individuals who this is their first time job, and we're helping them learn how to be good employees for the future, have to somehow be segregated out from the wages that we're paying to our full-time staff, that this is their profession. Because I know in my case, my wages certainly are not reflective of those numbers.
But some pushback here, because there are part-time workers, part-time staff, part-time servers who want to be full-time, but they don't know what that shift is going to look like maybe tomorrow or next week. And they know that the restaurant, you know, part-time, it allows that restaurant to hold down their labor costs, maybe not offering the full benefits, maybe allowing the restaurant to be more nimble to fluctuate hours. So there is definitely a downside to that part-time labor.
Certainly there is a downside to the part-time labor, but there is also an upside too. We provide jobs to people who otherwise would not be in the workforce. They want to work from 10 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon while their children are in school. They want to work on the weekends only because they themselves are going to school full time through college or perhaps pursuing a second career. The flexibility in restaurants and scheduling is something that I think is one of the virtues of our industry.
Talking with Danielle Berwald, board chair of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, hearing your insights on restaurants, 800-642-1234. Marianne joining us from Middleton. Hi, Marianne. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to make the comment that we made a real commitment to support restaurants that supported COVID safety during this pandemic. And our primary restaurant was located near the UW Hospital, and we felt that it was not only protective of the UW Hospital medical staff that might lunch there, it was also protective of the elder customers that would dine there. They boasted all staff are vaccinated. They had very lovely outdoor seating. And in the fall of 2020, they invested in an HVAC system that imitates the hospital for maximum ventilation of air and safety within their dining room. In 2021, they started the policy where if you want to dine in, you must be vaccinated. If you want to sit outside and eat, you can be unvaccinated.
They made great, great measures. Marianne, you're listing off a number of them, and I want to get Danielle here to respond to that. What do you make of these restaurants who really clamp down on public health?
I think it's a great investment on their behalf. Certainly, I want to be of the position that the restaurants have their own decisions to make regarding what works best for them and their customers. The support that we saw during the pandemic for small business was amazing. And I'd like to thank the listener for that comment. We did go, many, many restaurants went above and beyond whatever their communities were recommending to make sure that their customers were safe. And we still do. But I like to think that it is up to the businesses to make those decisions for themselves.
Last month, acting Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson issued a new mandate requiring people to wear face coverings in public spaces. And your association warned such a mandate will have a chilling effect on businesses. What do you make of masks?
Well, I think it's, again, up to the business. Every business is different and has a different clientele. We have left it optional for our staff to wear masks. Some of them do and some do not. We have made it mandatory for any of our unvaccinated individuals, of which we only have a couple, to wear masks while they are working. The chilling effect comes from when you make a mandate like that in a large city like Milwaukee, it sends a message to the public that it's not safe to go out. And I don't believe that's true. We've been serving people safely in our restaurants for almost 2 years now, both carry out and, you know, initially in the pandemic, and then dining in as of the summer of 2020 or 2019. And the idea that it's not safe, that comes across loud and clear when you mandate masks once again, instead of letting the individuals make their own choices of what's best for them.
Danielle Bearwald with us, restaurant owner, new board chair of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, nonprofit trade group formed nearly 90 years ago. How do you feel restaurants are weathering these times? Should patrons be required to wear masks? How would you like to see restaurants draw in their workforce, keep people in the industry? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking with the Wisconsin Restaurant Association on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The restaurant industry has been one of the hardest hit. The National Restaurant Association survey of operators out this month finds 88% of restaurants have seen a decline in customer demand for indoor dining in the Omicron surge. How is yours doing? Your favorite one, favorite restaurant, 800-642-1234. Danielle Bearwald, board chair of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, with us for nine more minutes. Jerry is joining us in Viola. Jerry, hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
I love that we're talking about restaurant workers. It seems like we were a forgotten class for decades. I'm involved with several restaurants, and I'm just going to put it out there. Restaurant workers should and deserve to get paid more, and I don't think it has to affect the bottom line. Because you can have more efficient people if you have a happier staff and you have less turnover. And I think it's just time to pay these people.
Jerry, let me ask you this, Jerry. How might this model that we're seeing of paying restaurant staff a living wage, do you see that as a more sustainable restaurant business model that will emerge post-pandemic? Do you see that as here to stay?
I've been involved my whole life in restaurants, and I oversee 9 restaurants. And restaurants that have paid more in the past have fared better during the pandemic and pre-pandemic by paying their people more. Just they have less turnover. Their customers get to know their staff. I always say you can pay people more and have a lower labor percentage. And people always say, oh, how can you do that? Well, by the reasons I just stated, you know, retaining staff and having them be more efficient because they know what they're doing. You're not training some new guy every 2 weeks.
Jerry, so. You bring up a lot of points. Let's get Danielle to weigh in here. Go ahead, Danielle.
I agree 100%. I think the market at this point, at least in the Milwaukee area, you will not get applicants walking in the door for something that is under $15 an hour. They're not coming in. Whether you're looking for a dishwasher or a cook, they're simply not applying. Even at higher wage rates, they're not applying. So if you want to keep the people you have and you want quality employees, you have to pay them, and you should be paying them. Honestly, they're good workers. They work hard. They represent your business. The people in the front of the house are the face of your business with the interaction with the customers on a daily basis. That's your investment. That's the way that you reach your customers and bring your customers back. And it is absolutely correct that's the most important thing you can do for your business is pay your people well to keep them.
Jerry, thank you for calling in. Kathy now in Milwaukee. Hi, Kathy. What is on your mind?
I just wanted to say the previous caller made great points. I was going to say when I worked at the Hilton Milwaukee City Center, we only made $5 an hour. We were union. That was considered high for a server to be making. And since we were union, our union dues were taken out. So if we weren't making tips that week, we weren't making money. So also, as to your guest's point, why I don't believe teenagers should be miscounted. I believe they should be paid equally. They're doing the same job that other people are. and they are doing the work, they're putting in the work, so they should get paid equally. They are saving for their futures. They may be providing for their families. They deserve equal pay. And that's all I wanted to tell.
Kathy, are you still in the restaurant industry or hospitality?
Yeah, we've been in, yes, absolutely. We've been in there for the last 5 to 7 years.
How has it been for you? What have you noticed in these times?
Well, besides getting laid off for, 8 months, it's been incredibly easy to walk into a place and, try to find new employment. But that was never really an issue in the service industry because, as the previous guest had mentioned, turnover is incredibly rampant because when you're not getting paid and you're not getting the hours you want, somebody else will give you that. So it's really easy to just walk in somewhere else. And so retention in the service industry is a huge issue.
Kathy, thank you for giving us a glimpse. Danielle, retention, a huge issue.
Absolutely. And along those lines, I would just want to mention something that at least we at IRVS are very, very proud of. Our average employee at IRVS has been there over 8 years, with our longest being 41 years. We've been in business for 43.
Wow.
So we work very hard to keep the people that are good employees and keep them happy and make sure that they represent our business well.
Talking with Danielle Bearwald, board chair of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association and owner of a restaurant in Oak Creek. Danielle, patrons also very concerned about tipping, that front of house servers rely too heavily on them and your customer doesn't know if giving that tip, doesn't know whether it's going to be distributed with back of house that might have had even a greater role in your meal. What is your philosophy about the state of tipping?
Well, for my staff, my servers, my bartenders vehemently oppose abolishing tipping. They want to keep that. All of our servers and bartenders keep the tips that they make themselves. In order to have any back of the house or other personnel that are traditional non-tipped employees share in a tip pool, one need to pay everybody above minimum wage, and you need to have an agreement on that. So it's you can't just unilaterally decide, oh, we're going to share the tips with the cooks tonight. There have to be agreements in place, and there are safeguards to make sure that the tipped employees are making at least a minimum wage.
It's not something you can just blink and institute. It's something that it sounds like a restructuring of how you pay employees.
Correct. Correct.
Let's go to Troy now in Muskego. Troy, hi.
Hello. I got 2 points. One of them is I noticed when this thing started getting really thick with this pandemic and a lot of the red areas politically, I feel like restaurants, they're pillars of the community and they serve the community. And I know a lot of business owners and a lot of restaurant owners. And a lot of them showed a blatant disregard for the health and safety of the community they serve. And, I mean, there are some places you couldn't even go in, and they didn't even have hand sanitizer, And I think that just shows a blatant disregard for the people they serve. And I feel like if they go under, that's on them. And another thing is, just a real quick point, is it's kind of irritating that as customers, we're having to pay these tips for, fast food restaurants where they're putting a little spot there. Like I know one place in particular, when you order a sub, they automatically ask you for a tip right up front when you're paying at the register for it to go takeout. And that's totally irresponsible for the business owners. They're, instead of giving their employees a higher wage, they're passing the buck on to me, the customer.
And Troy, thank you. And I want to shift this back to Danielle in our final moments here. Troy starting out saying restaurants are the pillar of the community. Go ahead, Danielle.
Well, I agree with Troy, and supporting those restaurants that you want to see remain is how you make sure that those restaurants that are doing things that you agree with stay in business. The ones that are taking the extra precautions, the ones that you see the same employees over and over again, you know that they're treating their employees right. You know that they're doing the things that are in the best interest for their customers. And that's that's your power. That's the customer's power to vote with their dollars and support the people who are making, support the businesses who are making those decisions.
Danielle, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Danielle Bearwald is board chair of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, owner of Irv's Mug in Oak Creek. Ahead this hour, the influence of the president on federal judgeship appointments. We talk with the UW-Milwaukee political scientist about President Biden's drive to seat federal judges. Has the process of confirming judges become too polarized or entrenched, or is this inevitable? 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a chance encounter with a squirrel.
When writer Ron Weber decided to go for a walk on a pleasant January day, he encountered an unexpected companion. Their shared journey was both amusing and inspiring, offering Weber a thoughtful reflection on the importance of play.
I opened my jacket as I walked, odd for midwinter, but the warmth of a January thaw was welcome. I decided to grab a quick snack as it was pushing noon. Munching on mixed nuts, I caught a glimpse of movement up ahead. A gray squirrel, a portly fellow who looked as though he had taken his task of fattening up for winter seriously, entered stage left. He rummaged through the softening snow until he reached a large basswood and promptly scurried into the treetop. My eyes followed him from one branch to the next, passing into a neighboring ash. By the next tree, I had joined the squirrel on his journey. I scanned the branches ahead, trying to anticipate our next move. Though a few times I got it right, my guide often had other ideas. I trusted his judgment on such things, so on we went. The fifth treetop looked like the end of the line. There was a 2-foot gap to cross to reach the next tree. That appeared to be the least of our problems. The closest branches on each tree looked like they would have a hard time supporting a chickadee, much less a 2-pound squirrel. It was a fun ride while it lasted. I imagine in squirrel school, pupils learn that traveling in the treetops is safer than on the ground, where predators await from there and above. The curriculum, I would hope, must also cover the physics and limitations of treetop travel. Much to my surprise, or shall I say horror, he started shimmying out onto the branch. He laid out flat like someone trying to get off thin ice and began inching forward. Then, much to my delight, with the flick of his tail, he backed up and got onto a thicker part of the branch. I thought he had finally come to his senses, but in a flash, he simply dropped down to a lower part of the same branch and again crawled out toward the end. I knew then he had no intention of backing away from this challenge. He was going to jump. Sir Isaac Newton clearly stated in his third law of motion that for every action force, there is an equal and opposite reaction force. I had seen this demonstrated many times, most applicable to this situation, by a friend who tried to jump from our boat onto the dock. But as he pushed off the boat moved further away from the dock, and he came up short and in the drink. I was hoping my newfound friend hadn't slept through science class and missed learning this important tenet of science from the headmaster squirrel. In an instant, he was in midair. He sailed across the chasm, grabbing the thin branch of the next tree. The branch swung down, and like Tarzan on a vine, he rode the branch forward, letting go at the perfect time, his momentum carrying him to a sturdy part of the branch. A human pulling off such a feat would be jumping up and down and taking a selfie. My buddy, without a bow, tail wag, or paw pump, kept right on going. 2 more treetops and we reached an oak in which an uprooted basswood was wedged. He used this to make his way back to terra firma. I was back down now too, and with a flick of his tail as if to say goodbye, he exited stage right. After watching so many animals, I know fun and play are important to them. I want to believe that other than the practical reason of safe travel, he had gone on this journey for the fun of it. I was glad he had taken me along.
Ron Weber is a writer and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to President Biden seating federal judges. Biden had a record first year compared to numbers of confirmations put up by six presidents before. The Senate recently confirmed his 42nd judicial appointment. But as Brookings points out, 1 year is merely a snapshot, and the Trump administration's modest first year judicial confirmations didn't predict its large number in the end. Do you think President Biden is moving too fast or not fast enough on judgeships? What are your thoughts about the next Supreme Court justice? 800-642-1234. Sarah Benesch is an associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee, where she studies judicial decision-making and the legitimacy of courts and institutions. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate.
Well, looking at these numbers, over 4 years in the Trump administration, 226 of his nominees join the federal bench, where, as I mentioned, just over a year into the Biden presidency, he can count 42 new judges. What is the significance of these judges? Why do these appointments matter?
Well, of course, it matters which person sits on the federal bench, because judges have different backgrounds and different preferences, and oftentimes the law is indeterminate. And so when you have a judge who believes in certain values or has certain life experiences, we expect that those judges are going to decide in different ways. So it matters very much who sits on the federal courts. And that's something that was generally more recognized by Republicans than Democrats, but it appears to be the case that the Biden administration is putting a very high priority on filling federal judgeships.
It's catching on, if you will.
Right. They figured it out.
Well, when you say a judge's background and preferences, what about the diversity of the background of these judges, or be it they're a prosecutor or they've been a public defender or they worked for an innocence project or taking civil rights cases? Why is their background something to pay close attention to?
Yeah, it appears to be the case that the Biden administration is really paying very close attention to the backgrounds of its nominees. And so we're seeing a lot more women, a lot more judges of color. And as you said, a lot of judges that have different backgrounds than what we generally expect to see in federal judges. So the tradition has been that federal prosecutors have been far more likely to be on the path to a federal judgeship. And the Biden administration has really highlighted the desire to include public defenders among its nominees for the reason that they feel like, as I said before, life experiences matter. And so in order to provide a little bit more empathy, in order to provide people with the judicial judgeship that have experience with poor people, for example, that see what happens in people's lives that lead them to trials in courts and in the criminal justice system has been really important to the Biden administration. So we know that judges do decide differently depending on their background, especially in certain specific kinds of cases. And that's exactly what the Biden administration appears to be looking for.
Sarah, can you give us a little sense of what the process is for these federal judges to be appointed? What is that on-ramp and making sure that we understand how they become a federal judge?
Sure. So it's a process that happens in consultation with the Senate. So we know that the Constitution provides for the president to nominate federal judges, but for the Senate to advise and consent. There's a lot of debate over what advise and consent means and how deferential or influential the Senate ought to be in the process. There have been differences across administrations in terms of how deferential the administration is to the home state senators, for example. But when a federal judgeship is vacant, the senators from the home state generally find a way to forward some nominees to the president's desk. The president then chooses which nominees to put forward to the Senate. The Senate conducts a hearing and obtains a whole bunch of information and does some background checks for that judge. And then they, if they decide to move forward, will forward that nomination to the full Senate for approval. We know now that, of course, we only need a majority of the senators to confirm a judicial nomination. And so, you know, part of the calculus of any administration is whether or not they're going to get those nominees confirmed, because, of course, it doesn't matter if you nominate a judge if the Senate decides to reject that judge. So that kind of goes into the front end of the president's decision, this idea of confirmability.
Confirmability. So if President Biden were to lose the Senate, could confirmations become a lot more difficult?
Yes, they absolutely will. And that's part of the reason why we see this expediency on the part of the Biden administration. They recognize that right now is the time that they need to take advantage of their control of the Senate. Democratic senators have all voted in favor of all of the Biden nominations. So the Democratic caucus is very in tune with each other on this topic, even though we've seen some disagreement among Democratic senators on other topics. And so they are certainly moving as fast as they can, both at the lower federal level and I would expect at the Supreme Court level.
Let's look at just one appointee here, one of Biden's appointees, whose nomination still pending before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Judge William Pocan. Pocan has been tapped to fill an open seat on the federal court in Wisconsin's Eastern District in Green Bay. What can you tell us about this appointment?
Well, it was a bipartisan selection. So Senator Baldwin and Senator Johnson convened a bipartisan nominating commission in order to identify some candidates for their consideration. They came up with four candidates, and William Pocan was their choice to forward to the Biden administration. So he has the support of both home state senators, even though they are, of course, of different parties. And the attention that we're seeing for Judge Pocan has stemmed largely from his background as well. And so if he were confirmed, he'll be the first LGBT Article III judge in the Seventh Circuit.
The last name Pocan, relation there to Representative Mark Pocan, right?
Yes, that's his brother.
His brother. UW-Milwaukee political scientist Sarah Benish with us, giving us insights on judicial appointments, how the process works, what she sees coming out of the Biden administration. Are you following judicial appointments? What federal judgeships have stood out to you and why? How do you feel about the confirmation process of federal judges and the advise and consent that we've been talking about? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. President Biden campaigned on the fact that he wanted to appoint the first Black woman Supreme Court justice. It's a decision that we are seeing foreshadow a contentious process in Senate confirmation hearings. We'll get, you know, what will happen? Will he get her nomination through? And who is on the short list? 800-642-1234. UW-Milwaukee Political Science Department Chair Sarah Benish stays with us for 10 more minutes. So looking at the Supreme Court, the High Court, with Justice Stephen Breyer retirement, what does this vacancy mean to the court and to the Biden administration?
I think it's really important to the Biden administration for a number of reasons. The court's balance won't change with this appointment, and you've probably heard a lot of commentary about how conservative the court is now after the three Trump appointments. So the court is really a 6-3 court right now in terms of conservatives and liberals. And so it was important to a lot of the Democratic faithful, I guess, that Biden have an opportunity to appoint a young justice who would be on the bench for a long time in order to be certain to hang on to that minority seat that Breyer occupied. And given his increasing age, you know, there was some concern that if the Democrats were to lose the White House, they would lose that opportunity to at least try to solidify the minority coalition to keep those liberal positions at least, you know, on the record, I guess.
I wonder what you think about seating judges, seating a judge to the high court even. Has it become too entrenched in party politics? It used to be that a judge's training and temperament and resume were key factors. And now it's just like that political background is glaringly out there in front. Is that new or has it been this way?
It's not new. It's always been the case that senators have been driven by ideological interests and presidents have been driven by ideological interests in the nominations and confirmations process. But I think what's new is the polarization of the Senate. You know, so there was a time when we had senators that were moderate. There was a time when votes on items and issues were bipartisan in nature. There was a time when most appointments to the Supreme Court were confirmed nearly unanimously. So if you think about even, you know, as recently as Justice Ginsburg's nomination, she was not a non-controversial nominee in terms of the fact that, you know, her ideological predisposition was very clear, right? Mm-hmm. She was the leader of the ACLU's women's rights section. She was obviously a pro woman's right, pro equality, very liberal judge. But
she wore it on her sleeve, if you will.
Absolutely, there was no question. And a couple of senators voted against her, but most of them voted for her. You know, so there was a time when that was the case. And so I don't think it's necessarily the things that go into the nomination, because I think those things have always been political. And that's probably the way the framers intended it in putting it into the political branches. But the political branches have never been this polarized. And so I think that makes it even more partisan and even more political.
Let's bring on a caller. Ron is joining us from Blue Mounds. Ron, hi. What would you like to add?
Okay. My question this morning is, you know, we're talking about the selection of judges, and I want to know what degree of influence the Federalist Society and the American Constitution Society has on the selection of these judges. What I have felt is that during the Trump era and before that with the Bushes, they tended to lean to judges that were part of the philosophy, if you will, of the Federalist Society. And what I see now is an awareness from the Bidens that the Federalist Society and their philosophy is one of the divisions and the conflicts that's going on with the appointment of judges.
Ron, thank you for bringing this to the table. Sarah, go ahead.
Yeah, interest groups have frequently played a role in Supreme Court nominations, especially since around the time of the nomination of Robert Bork, who was not confirmed, largely because of a groundswell of opposition from liberal interest groups. But the Federalist Society has been special to Republican presidents in terms of the identification of nominees for judgeships. And President Trump certainly spent a lot of time consulting with the Federalist Society, in fact, almost allowing them to choose the list of candidates from which he would pick. Of course, the Biden administration is not as interested in the Federalist Society's input. So the Biden administration is looking to other interest groups to help identify candidates. But the Biden administration has also had a lot of experience in judicial selection. The chief of staff, Ron Klain, had a big role in a lot of judicial nominations. Biden himself, of course, was the chairperson of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And so they're not looking for as much outside help. But we will see many interest groups opining on the nominee. And that's a regular part of the process and definitely adds to the political nature of a Supreme Court nomination.
Sarah Benesch with us, political science chair at UW-Milwaukee. Your research focuses on judicial decision-making and the legitimacy of the courts. You can join in on judgeships, what you see, 800-642-1234. You know, it was first reported by the New York Times, former Senator Doug Jones of Alabama would be the Sherpa, the guide for President Biden's nominee through the confirmation process. So escorting the nominee to meetings with senators and the hearings. Are these pre-meetings before confirmation hearings important? And what about the pick of the so-called Sherpa?
I think it's important to have a person who is really keen on or has a really keen eye for politics and understands what the various senators are most interested in. And I think the meetings matter in terms of providing an opportunity for the senators to meet the nominee as a person, you know, and be able to interact with them, you know, as a person in a setting that is much more casual and relaxed. We have, you know, some indications that, you know, some of these senators will attempt
Confirmation hearings aren't relaxed and chilled?
No, I think we've experienced a couple recently and noticed that they're not exactly relaxed. Yeah. This is kind of an informal way for the senators to meet the nominee. And they often do well. They will try to get the nominee on record about certain specific issues. But of course, Supreme Court nominees are very good at being careful not to tip their hands too much.
Okay, so what is the timeline here? When will all this take place? When do you think Biden will make a decision first on a nominee?
Well, he's promised one by the end of February, and I think we can probably expect that that will happen. The Senate appears to be poised to start the confirmation hearings as soon as they have a nominee and want to get that confirmation hearing completed in a timely manner. So the length of the confirmation hearings in some ways will depend on what happens during them, right? So we know that the Kavanaugh hearing, for example, got a little longer than we expected it to be, given some allegations that arose. The candidates that President Biden is looking at, especially the front runner, who everyone seems to think is Ketanji Brown Jackson, has recently been confirmed by the same Senate and even garnered some Republican votes for her confirmation to the D.C. Circuit. And so we might expect that, you know, a nominee like that wouldn't have a whole lot of trouble getting through pretty quickly.
Well, we'll be watching. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Sarah Benesch, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Political Science at UW-Milwaukee. And we'll dig into an investigation, stay with us, of the prenatal care coordination industry by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which found fraud and millions of dollars flooding into this industry. News update is next. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.